Today's episode is sponsored by Saks Off Fifth, where you get Saks style for less. I'm talking up to 70% off of some of my favorite brands like Gani, Staud, and Stuart Weitzman. At Saks Off Fifth, you'll shop the latest fall fashion and designer discounts across clothing, shoes, handbags, beauty, and more for both women and men. Plus, they have new styles arriving every day. Experience the thrill of an amazing designer find at SaksOffFifth.com or at a store near you. Hi, everyone. I'm Hillary Kerr, the co-founder and chief content officer of Who What Wear, and this is Second Life, a podcast spotlighting women who have truly inspiring careers. We're talking about their work journeys, what they've learned from the process of setting aside their doubts or fears, and what happens when they embark on their second life. Today, I am so excited to sit down with Lisa Donovan, the CEO and founder of an app I have used for years, The Pattern. Developed and written by Lisa over a four-year period from her childhood bedroom, The Pattern launched quietly in 2018 with no marketing or PR, and overnight, literally, Lisa woke up to over 30,000 downloads. The Pattern is rooted in astrology, but instead of breaking down your birth chart with planets and houses, it provides patterns and timings which unlock keys to your personality traits by providing clarity on ways in which you operate in the world and relate to others. Plus, you can run compatibility matches called bonds with romantic interests or friends, and they're even working on a dating feature called Connect. With over 7.5 million users today and folks like Channing Tatum singing their praises on social media, it's somewhat surprising that Lisa didn't find her calling in astrology until her second life. Previously, she had a career in many forms of entertainment as an actress, megastar YouTube creator, you may remember her channel, Lisa Nova, a producer and co-founder of Maker Studios, a talent-focused technology and media company, which she ended up selling to Disney in 2014 for almost $700 million. It is a wild ride from the mile-a-minute digital media industry to finding deep joy and healing through astrology, and eventually bringing that knowledge to The Pattern, where she's connecting with millions of people once again. With no further ado, now, on Second Life, it's Lisa Donovan. Lisa, on this podcast, we always like to start at the beginning. So, what did you study in school and what did you think you were going to be when you grew up?
I actually studied political science. That was probably very influenced by my father, who was very political. He was a wedding photographer to make money, and I was his assistant. I have been to hundreds of weddings as his assistant. But he would make, you know, documentaries in his spare time. They would take him like 10 years at a time, and he was very into political stuff. So I think I was quite influenced by that and studied that in college. And what I wanted to be when I grew up, I mean, I feel it wasn't one particular thing. I'd say I think I wanted to have as many experiences as possible. I was all about the experience. How can I go out and just sort of get in the mix of life and consequently had every job that exists? I was really trying to figure out what it was I wanted to do. And I think I just knew I wanted to dive in and really did try my hand at a lot of different things.
So poli-sci is definitely an interesting major. Did that have any direct application on some of those early jobs? So what was your first job after school?
Well, even in college, I did a lot of volunteering. I did a lot of interning. I was an investigator for a public defender. I worked at a women's safe house where I was sort of on call for women if they were being abused or in jail. I would go and sort of advocate for them. I was doing sort of a lot of things in that world. And then I took, I guess, a sharp turn by moving out to LA. I wasn't sure what I wanted to do. I just wanted to take a little bit of time. And my brother was living in Los Angeles, and he was an actor, and it was a creative home I grew up in. I saw my father making these documentaries in his spare time. He was always telling us to go live our dreams and not get stuck doing something that you didn't love, because he didn't love being a wedding photographer. So at the end of those weddings, we'd drive home in the car and he'd be like, go live your dreams. Don't get stuck doing this. Try things, you know, just go and explore. So being in a creative home, I thought I'd go out to LA and see what that had to offer. And my first job out there was actually doing production design and learned about that. And, you know, they do the production design for like The Bachelor after the rose or whatever.
After the final rose? Are you serious? It.
Yeah, those, and the MTV New Year's Eve, I was there.
Yes.
And the Foo Fighters and Jack Black, you know, just setting up, doing the design, the production design there. So I learned about that, did that for about a year.
So I'm so fascinated by this piece of it. What does that exactly mean? Like, are you picking the furniture and designing a set?
I certainly wasn't. I knew nothing about it, but I, yes. The guy who's production designer, this guy and this woman, that is what they did. They designed all the sets of things, the furniture, the backdrops, the rugs, all the things. And it was way back in the day. So this place was on Abbot Kinney, when Abbot Kinney was just abandoned buildings. There was nothing there. And they had this great little place on sort of the corner of Abbot Kinney and Westminster. And that was my first job.
So you were a baby, though. So this was like just right out of college, right?
Right out of there. Yeah. I was a barista, too. That's not as interesting. Production design. But yeah.
I totally disagree. I will only say that I do think that some of those formative jobs and the skills that we learn when we're just starting out our careers, you might not realize that they're teaching you something that has direct application to future jobs, but there are always little things that you're learning that you're like, oh, I learned that at the Gap, or I learned that at my first job, or whatever it may be. So with production design, did you think, okay, this is something I really want to do, or this is, you know, just one thing to try per your earlier statement?
Yeah, it was just, I was going to give it a try and see what that led to. I didn't want it to be my career future getting into it. I think I realized pretty quickly that wasn't the route I wanted to go. And then I wound up getting a job through that job, through meeting someone where I was an assistant to the producer of the reality show, The Osbournes.
Oh my goodness. Can we talk about that, please?
Sure.
On the off chance that anyone doesn't know, I mean, The Osbournes was basically like the original reality TV.
Yeah, it was.
Did you know what you were doing at that point? Like, were you interested in reality TV? What was assisting like? Tell me everything, please.
It's sort of this thing of just kind of going with the flow and seeing what life offers you. You know, I knew I didn't want to do the production design. I met this producer. He was looking to hire someone. I said, let me give that a try. And then you learn a lot about what they do. You kind of watch them producing and what that entails. And, you know, he was generous with his time and good guy, and see the reality show and how it worked. And it was very interesting. And of course, he's an incredible character, the entire family. I think I was only there for about a year and a half, and I just kept moving. I've had so many jobs in my life. And I think ultimately leading me to wanting to sort of create my own thing is where I wound up feeling most comfortable.
So speaking of which, I read that you actually started your own production company.
I did. I was a waitress before that. I was a good waitress. Kitchen, everybody loved me because I didn't forget an order, but I actually was fired. That was the job I was fired from. The guy who ran it, he sat me down and he said, your heart's not in this. And I was like, well, yeah, of course. And I was like, I don't want to be a waitress. He's like, right. And I was like, what does it matter? I'm good at it. He's like, your heart's not in this. And I was like, you're right. And it was such a gift, which I'd always say anytime I've had to let someone go or you're being let go, it's usually a great opportunity because you're probably not in the right place.
What is that? They say it's not rejection, it's redirection.
Yes. And I like to say rejection is protection.
Yes.
I love that. I love being rejected in certain ways. I look at it in a very different way. I always flip it. I was like, this is great. There's something else coming. I mean, of course, there's the initial pang, you know, ego being like, oh. But then, you know, you get over it quick. And that's when I started a little production company. I mean, it sounds fancier than it was. It was mostly like corporate gigs. And my father being a photographer, I was a photographer. So you'd go to sort of corporate events and do photography and sizzle reels and things like that with the hopes of doing something more creative and personal with money if it came. It was also when I started to go into debt for the first time.
That's so fun. I did that also when you were starting Who What Wear. It took me a long time to dig out of that.
Oh, Oh my God, years.
Yeah, same. So for anyone who doesn't know what a sizzle reel is, can you explain that?
Oh yeah. You could go to like just a corporate event and you're shooting video of the event and you have to put together like a few minutes to sort of show how sizzling the event was.
Almost like a trailer for the event, right?
That's right. That's right.
So you were editing this yourself, I'm assuming?
Yeah. I mean, I had a partner in the business, as a guy I was dating at the time. And so it was just us.
So how did you get clients? What was the process of setting everything up like? I'm just so curious about what those early days are like, because that's got to be hard. I mean, like there are a million different types of production companies in LA. How did you differentiate yourself?
Yeah, I mean, mostly in the beginning, I had credit. So that was sort of my role of like, okay, I have credit, so I'll go buy the computers and I'll go buy the cameras. I didn't know much about any of it. It was sort of learning as I went, and I actually taught myself to edit during this process, so I'd have a skill. And I did have the photography, so when the jobs would come in, I do the photography, you do the videography, and then I learned to edit in this process. And I guess that was a year before we discovered YouTube, and then that sort of took in a different direction.
So tell me about that. Yeah, so YouTube starts again. This is the early 2000s, 2005-ish. Mm-hmm. You are still just out of school, I will point out. How did YouTube change the industry for you? How did it change things for your company, you personally?
I mean, it changed everything, yeah. It changed my life so dramatically. It was very early days, as you said. I mean, this is like when YouTube started. So there was no context for it. You know, I remember looking at the videos and being like, oh, people are commenting and talking about the video and to each other. You know, and it was a very small community. I mean, most people were really just in the rooms sort of vlogging before people mm-hmm. knew what vlogging was. And, you know, people only associated video content online with porn, you know?
So right.
Anytime I said that's what I was doing, people got very confused. And, you know, you're surrounded by a lot of actors and you're trying to get people to participate with you. And there's such hesitancy because they're like, that's going to be bad for me. You don't want to be on the internet. And you're trying to be like, yeah, no, this is amazing. You have no idea. This platform's incredible. And you're thinking kind of what eventually happened with it was going to happen even quicker. But yeah, I basically started this channel. And yeah, it was called Lisa Nova. We had a Chevy Nova growing up. And I thought it was kind of funny, you know, like Casanova or Supernova, you know, just because my name had been taken already and shot and edited something and put it up. And yeah, and it sort of just took off right away. I think a lot of it was YouTube was really excited. Somebody was making, I mean, I wouldn't even call it produced, but it was more than vlogging. I was making this sort of pop culture parodies. So I think they were excited. And back then, if you were on the home page or featured at all, it was just massive. You know, everybody there would see your video. So that happened pretty quickly. And all of a sudden, you have all these people commenting on your video, which is the greatest way to humble yourself.
Right.
Start making YouTube videos.
Right. Okay. So was this just a side project at that point in time? Did you have like a content calendar? How much content were you making? Like, what was the process like at that moment?
I mean, you have no idea if anybody's going to even watch it. So I just made that one. I just made that one on my own and put it up. And I didn't even know what to say. So I just had this song and just sort of put it up. And then it was like, oh, whoa, you know, it sort of took off. And I made a couple. I just make them on the fly really quickly. And I love to edit because really editing is directing. It's writing. You can do anything with what you shot. So I just started playing around and making these things. And it really did sort of right away was getting all this viewership. So it felt like, whoa, you better keep up because people are like, where's the next video? Where's the next video? And so I felt like I was always just sort of catching up, doing it on the fly. And I got an email from Mad TV.
Whoa.
They wanted me to come in and do my characters. And I remember being like, my characters? I was like, what? And I went to my brother, who's an actor, and he was in my early videos. He wrote a lot of the stuff too. And I was like, they're asking if I have characters. And I got to go in and sort of audition with these characters. So we sat down and wrote that stuff. And I didn't consider myself a comedian or even really an actor. I enjoyed improvising. I enjoyed writing things, editing. And I went in and did these characters and wound up getting cast on that show off the kind of third video.
That is insane on so many levels. Also, to give people some context here, I mean, your channel also blew up. You had 500,000 subscribers. You were getting a ton of press. Did you feel successful in that moment? Or was there a moment where you thought like, oh, this is a thing?
It's so funny when you're doing it, you're not sort of self-aware of what you're doing. I didn't feel like I was some massive success. One, you know, you're in a lot of debt. You have a job. You still have to work really. There wasn't any money in it. So you're really grinding, right? So you're working all the time. And mm-hmm. it's exciting because you have this sort of platform, and that was sort of thrilling, you know, and the idea of what you could create and what you could put out there. I was also very sort of hard on myself back then. So I wasn't maybe able to see it as, oh, I'm so successful. I didn't see it that way. I was like, oh, there's more to do, or there's more videos to make, or it's not enough. You know, you have to sort of keep going. But it was also very thrilling and very exciting, and sort of what YouTube did grow into. I think I was saying earlier, I thought would kind of happen right away. And even with the Mad TV, I would only do it if in the contract I could keep doing YouTube. And that was a really funny moment because nobody really understood that. They're like, why? They're like, but it's over. You've been discovered. I was like, no, but this is the thing. This is the future. So it was this whole long thing. I was this really annoying online talent, you know, because I knew I wanted to keep on there, but you know, it was going to be years before you could be in, you know, rev share partnership with Google. And even if you were getting millions of views, the CPMs were really low. So you always had to be working another job. So it was a very interesting thing to have sort of that feeling of you need to create content consistently all the time, but you mm-hmm. also have to be working all the time doing other stuff. So yeah, it was a mix of those things. It was really exciting and really thrilling, but also a lot of work.
Sounds like a grind, but I mean, it's like this thing that you love, but it's also yes. not making you any money, but you also know it's an investment in the future right. and it's something that feeds you creatively. So you keep doing it.
Exactly. And trying to balance that too, you know, because eventually it can cross over into losing the love of it. Mm. You need it to survive.
Right. So burnout is real. So yeah. A few years into this, so like around 2009, you realized the opportunity within this space was much bigger than your one but highly successful channel, and you started Maker Studios. So tell me about the initial idea. Did you test it before starting another company? What was your process like?
I mean, it was sort of a natural progression in a certain way. What was great is it was a small community, you know, so mm-hmm. originally, we did like a brand deal back then. That was a way as a YouTube content creator, a brand would come and you'd sort of integrate the brand into your video. And we were doing one for this movie called Crank. And I had all these YouTubers come out and they were in the video and we all worked together. It just sort of made sense that coming together and sharing resources and driving audience to one another and working sort of as a team, united artists kind of thing, there'd be a much bigger business and opportunity for everybody and just sharing in that. And so we moved a lot of people to Los Angeles. And again, I had the credit, as you know,
yep,
the more you go in debt, the more credit they give you.
It's amazing.
It's like, it's so crazy. So I got, you know, leases in my name. We'd move YouTube content creators out. And I just went sort of in more debt, you know, into this studio model, which was to, you know, help also create content for other YouTube creators who didn't have those kinds of resources as well. So it was really like a little studio in the beginning. And then that model eventually had to change into more of a network model and offer other things because it wasn't as sustainable when it was just the studio model. So that sort of grew and that allowed us to actually invest in many people, you know, all over the world who weren't necessarily at our studio. And that was really, really interesting because, again, I was a YouTube content creator.
Yeah.
And so I was doing that in the beginning. And that's also, we were unfunded for the first 18 months. And everything I'd make, I'd put back in. That's when it became a lot more of creating content really to feed something bigger. Mm-hmm. And the burnout really became real. Like, you're coming up with any concept you can just to have content. I did like a vlog series where I was a teenage girl living in our grandmother's garage, but I do it every single day just because I had, you know, any kind of sort of creative piece of content you could come up with because you needed to do that to sort of, you know, feed the bigger dream. And then it sort of moved into me being more behind the scenes and learning a lot more about business.
Did you like that piece of it? Because, you know, there are creative people who love the business side of it. There are creative people who do not. There are creative people who do it because they have to. But it's definitely like a different part of the brain in some ways. It's creative in its own way, but it's definitely a different muscle. So what was that like for you?
Yeah, it is. It is a very different muscle. You know, it wasn't something I think I ever dreamed about doing. It wasn't something I was like, oh, I'll be in business. That never occurred to me. It's just, I think I thought I'd be much more in a creative profession, but it's something that keeps sort of coming into my life. And I am curious and interested and just sort of dive into things. So I think it was one of those things that I dove into without thinking in a certain way. Mm-hmm. And then you learn, and it actually winds up being an incredibly creative experience. And especially then, because it was really the Wild West, you know, this whole business didn't exist. So you're creating a whole new model. And especially in a world where people still didn't really get YouTube. I mean, it was such an uphill battle always as to why this is relevant, as to why these content creators were just as relevant as the traditional celebrity. And having brands try and understand why that was important, or even having ad revenue going towards YouTube content creators, was just something you were constantly trying to get people to see.
Oh my God, I remember doing that too, like with Who What Wear. Think about the fashion industry in 2006, 2007, 2008. Yeah. Like, I feel you so deeply on that, because there were obviously brands like Gucci and Burberry that fully got it from the jump. But there were so many fashion brands, especially luxury brands and historic brands and heritage brands, that still looked at the internet as gross. So
that's right. Gross. That's exactly it.
And they didn't want anything to do with it. And you would try to explain and they didn't see the value. And it's tiring. I mean, it's frustrating sometimes when you're like trying to explain to people something that's so obvious to you that they just don't have any interest in.
That's it. And that's kind of what I was trying to answer earlier. So that's why you don't think of yourself, oh, I'm so successful, because you're really, nobody really gets it. You have literally this audience of like, you know, 20,000 people in the beginning who are like, this is great. And everybody else is like, are you insane? You know, what are you doing? And nobody gets it. And you're just trying to explain there's something exciting here. This is a thing.
I guess that's the issue of being a pioneer. It's like, how do you feel successful when you're creating something new, when all of the, you know, traditional markers or like traditional stakeholders don't value it, but you have your own audience that is obsessed? What a weird dichotomy.
That's it. It's hard to explain that, you know, and that's sort of why there was a place for Maker, because we understood talent in this very particular position, because it's not like they were famous to most people, but to their audience, they were really important, you know? It was a very unique thing. It was a very special moment sort of in time, and everything is timing. And I was just in the right place at the right time and sort of put in those 10,000 hours, I guess. But it was a unique moment. And that's what the business grew out of this thing of like, oh yeah, nobody gets that this is relevant. Even the platform at the time didn't 100% get that, you know? So, and you were like, no, these guys are so great. Who cares about those other celebrities? You know, because a lot of it was about how do we get the celebrities to get on this platform? Because then it'll be real. And we're like, no, these people, they're here.
Yeah.
So it was such early days and of being what now is, you know, an influencer, which is just obvious, you know, but then it was really trying to sell the idea of these are influencers. What they say matters. It maybe matters more than that celebrity you really want to be on this site.
Right.
So that was the business, you know, and I did a lot of operational stuff, production, and I did really enjoy it. And I think I was very burnt out of creating content. I was like, if I have to create one more video, you know, because it's so much energy. And I was straddling both, where I was creating content, but also helping to run the business. And also financially, so much of it was on my shoulders too.
On your credit?
Yeah, on my credit. You know, it was going to be my problem if it didn't work out, essentially. So, you know, you're straddling it all. And then eventually it was great because I could just sort of bow out of being a content creator and just was on the business side. And, you know, I think because it was something that didn't exist and there wasn't a model, that's probably also what attracted me to it. What was most interesting, exciting, and compelling about it, the experience, was just a very rich one for my life.
So wait, speaking of that, I want to get into the stepping back from content creation piece of it. But before, I also want to talk about the fact that essentially what you guys were doing is creating viral content with your creators. I mean, everyone says like, I want a piece of viral content, or advertisers want something to go viral. But it's basically like saying, I want to create lightning in a bottle. I want something magical to happen. And it's really hard to do, even in the most pure creative sense, let alone within a business context. So how did you guys do that? And also, you know, I like the flip side of this. Did you ever get it wrong?
Oh, I mean, yeah, I must have made over 500 videos. So much of it is, you know, objectively going to be a failure. It's a portfolio. You're just putting things out. I mean, I kind of love the sort of in the moment pop culture, something would happen and you'd create a video right away. That was really, for me personally, very fun.
Yeah.
Because you could do it that day.
Like your own SNL.
Right. Like Sarah Palin, it was fun, you know, because we were able to do that right away. And then CNN puts your video on, or, you know, goes viral, as they say. So those were sort of fun moments where that would happen. But most of the time, you know, you're throwing things out there and seeing how it goes. So much of it is considered a failure. And it's a great way to just humble yourself and lose some of the ego's hold on you, because, you know, you're going to create something and people are going to have some pretty horrible things to say about it sometimes. Sometimes it's nice, sometimes it's not, but you learn to not let it impact you so much, which was also a tremendous advantage. I love learning that sort of lesson. But ultimately, what we try to do with most talent is trying to find formats, you know, the way you would have a format of a show, because it was really about the connection with the talent and the audience. I would say my channel is an aberration. I'd always be like, don't do what I did, because I was not formulaic. It was a very different thing. What we try and do is be like, what's your thing, and find your niche. You don't need everybody to love you. Find your niche, you know, and speak to them. So then it would be more about consistent. And some people were getting millions of views consistently. Some had smaller channels, and some people were sort of consistently viral in a certain way that they got so many views. And then some, you know, once in a while they'd have a viral video. So it was very much a portfolio approach. And same with even investing in talent. You were doing it in a portfolio way, hoping, you know, certain ones would pop off, and then that could subsidize the rest.
Interesting. I like that. So we had Michelle Phan on the podcast, obviously also a successful creator, digital pioneer, great entrepreneur. And she talked about all of the pressure that she felt that led to her taking a hiatus. Did you feel that same pressure? You mentioned like you were excited at one point when you were like, okay, great, I can sort of step back from the outward facing piece of this and focus on more of the behind the scenes. Like, what was the tipping point for you?
Oh, yeah. I was very burnt out in creating content, because it starts from a place of just this joy and fun and love, and there's no money in it. It's not even about that. It's just this creative fun experience. And then it really becomes how you're making your living, and there's a lot of pressure on it, right? And you're just feeding the beast all the time. And then that sort of takes away from the joy of it. So by the time I was going behind the scenes, running the business, I would have stopped years before. It's just also, I was putting money from my channel into the business. So I needed to do it. Yeah, I was super burnt out on that before, you know, Maker even.
Yeah. So you also had to scale the company in a really massive way. How did you grow internally? How did that change your day to day? Did you like that change? Tell me about that time.
Yeah, and a lot of this is that timing, you know, and there was just all this opportunity to scale, because there was this hole where nobody understood how important this talent was. And so there were so many talent that needed that help and that support. So we grew out of necessity. You know, we started in like a little small office, and then we got this other office, and then we got one across the street above a taco place, and then we got, you know, 50,000 square foot place. It just kept growing because we needed it. We kept signing more and more talent. I mean, like I said, we were 18 months unfunded. It was great. We'd get by, but if we wanted to go to that next level of what we saw this could be, we needed investment, took that, and then you could start making a lot more hires, and then you can bring in a lot more talent. And in those early days too, it was so much of hiring family, friends, like everybody I knew was working at the business, and then their friends, and then their friends. You're young, you're figuring it out. It was learning as you go, but also when you learn those lessons, they're like in your bones, you never forget them, right? Because the stakes are so high. It's real. It's real people's lives. And every single person you're bringing out, you feel the weight of that. And you're like convincing people to like, yeah, go for it. Create this content. Yeah, leave your job. okay, we'll pay you this much to invest in yourself. You know, it was a lot of that.
Yeah.
And it's very personal. And the job never stopped. It was 24 hours a day, you know, because you're there to also support talent, you know, and they're coming over after work. And there was no off, if that makes sense. It was just years and years of going full speed because the nature of that business and how fast it was scaling.
I mean, that's overwhelming. But on the flip side of that, you also exited with a massive sale to Disney for almost $700 million in 2014. I remember reading about it at the time, and I just thought it's like one of the dream stories from my perspective. So tell me a little bit about that conversation, how it started, the thought about selling. Was this always the goal? Like, tell me about that time.
Well, yeah, I mean, gosh, again, talk about like life experiences. It was just tremendous life experience. And the first time we even took investment, I knew nothing about that. I learned these things as they happen. And again, this was a little bit before being an entrepreneur was a thing, you know what I mean? And you could talk to all these people. So everything was so new. It's like, okay, well, what's a venture capital? What is that? Yeah. Learning about all these things, right? So everything about it was new, and that's what was exciting. And I think what was happening by the time we're going to sell, you know, one, when it's Disney coming along, that's a very specific thing. It's not like you want to sell to any place.
Right.
Disney is this incredible company. And for me too, just being a YouTuber and knowing what was going on at this point, there's a lot of MCNs, these sort of other companies like us that were popping up, right? So there's a bit more competition. On top of it, things were changing. People were getting it and YouTube was seeing it. And I saw sort of, okay, a year from now, they'll probably be our competitor. So this is probably the greatest time. We're at our peak. It's the right company, and it made a lot of sense to go down that route, you know, and obviously, yeah, I mean, it was just sort of incredible and a lot of serendipity and how it all sort of worked out, yeah, from starting it till selling it in 5 years. And, you know, wanting to also take care of everybody who was involved, you know, make good on all the promises. Again, this was a very personal thing. You're dealing with the talent and the people working for you, and there's a tremendous sense of responsibility and just wanting to have it work out for everybody, all that you invested in, everybody in their time. And, you know, it was a really exciting time and making a lot of people who were there early millionaires. And, you know, it was just exciting to make good on sort of your promises.
I'll say.
But yeah, I mean, there's a whole, it's not easy too. It's a mix of things.
Yeah, because this is your baby.
Yeah.
Like you built this from the ground up, and then on some level, I feel like this is sort of the American dream to exit like that. But like, how did you feel personally? Because to go from foot on the gas for 5 years without stopping, and then all of a sudden, it's just done in some ways.
Yeah, I mean, and there was a lot going on too on a personal level, I will say. And I was changing, and the dynamics of the business were changing, and we brought in a different CEO. There's a lot of things on a personal level that were happening that were very intense too, and coloring a lot of what I was going through. So I know what you mean, that it's your baby. I'm not a possessive person.
Great.
You know, you're a parent and you let the child go. You got to know when to let go and say, okay, wow, this is great and everybody's taken care of. And, you know, ideally it's in service to something and this is its time. And everything to me is timing. And you got to pay really close attention to your intuition and signals and what's happening and know when it's time. And I felt very, very clear about that. And I was very at peace with that. And it's also, like I said, on a personal level, when my life was changing pretty dramatically and who I was as a person fundamentally was changing. And I was starting to be interested in very different things as well. And eventually, you know, this experience in my life and everything led to creating the pattern. And I think a lot of maybe the more complex side of what I was going through in my personal life sort of gave birth to this new path I was going down. So I was okay. It was time to move on.
On to the next. So speaking of which, let's talk about the pattern. I can't even remember when I downloaded it, but I remember calling my mom and frantically demanding that she send me, that she go and look at my birth certificate to tell me the exact time I was born, and then harassing my mother-in-law for the same information for my husband. But enough about me. Tell me about how you decided to start the pattern, what the initial idea was, how you started working on it, and what it is in general for anyone who's not like me and personally obsessed.
Well, thank you for being on it and caring about the bird's eye. It's so important. Yeah, so it really came from a very natural place, and it was from a very personal place. As I was sort of touching on earlier, I was going through a personal transformation. A lot of who I thought I was and the life I was going to have and the people in my life and the business I thought I was running, everything, you know, you'd say your personality or ego construct sort of was shattered, you know, and I was having a real personal reckoning with myself and the choices I'd made. And, you know, there was breakup, there was, you know, my father getting sick. There was a lot of things in my life that were changing, and it sort of broke me open and humbled me, and I was sort of rebuilding myself. And at that time, I wound up having an astrology reading, and I was not necessarily like somebody who would have been so into astrology. I grew up in a very like logical home, you know, it wasn't very spiritual. I thought maybe it was a little woo-woo or cheesy, but I had this reading, and again, my life was in a very unstable, sort of vulnerable time, and it was incredible because he gave me sort of a psychological breakdown of who I was, you know, my deepest insecurities and fears and the things I was going through at that time. And instead of it being this cheesy new agey thing, it was much more of a psychological breakdown and explaining a lot of things that I had struggled with in life. And I just became obsessed with what is this magic? And, you know, just reading everywhere and online and searching frantically for something that could mimic that experience that I just had with this astrologer, an app, a website, and there was nothing out there. And that's sort of what gave birth to the idea. I was like, I wish I could somehow, you know, mimic my experience, put it into an app so it was scalable and everybody could have this information. Wouldn't that be incredible? Because it would be such a tool for people, so helpful. Because if I had known some of this stuff, you know, 20 years earlier, and so I thought that would be super easy. And I was like, I'll just do that, you know, and this is literally on the heel. I mean, Maker was done, all this was done. And instead of taking a break, which would have made more sense, there was a sort of like creative fire in me. And I set out to create the pattern. And it wasn't easy, as this was 7 years ago. I thought I could do this real quick because there was nobody to hire. Once again, it didn't really sort of exist what I wanted. So I found this astrologer, and I basically, he was in his 70s, he was traveling all over the world, and I would sort of get him to sit with me for like a week at a time, and I just start extracting the information from him because it's, you know, an oral tradition, and I basically had to learn the system. And I basically spent years doing that, learning the system, sort of creating these astrology algorithms. I found a coder who knew astrology, so he could code that for me, and then I started the process of writing the content, which really took years and years. And it was when my father got sick, so I wound up moving home after selling. I was with him the year before he passed, and then I wound up staying with my mom, and this is where my childhood bedroom, I wrote the pattern. I just write 10 hours a day.
Wow. You know,
have dinner with mom, watch Johnny Carson reruns, do it again the next day. I had no relationship. I had no social life. I really was just passion, obsession, but also a catharsis. It was a way to process a lot of the things I had gone through and was going through in my life and to sort of make sense of all these things that were happening. And it was just another sort of, you know, creative expression. If I could make music, I would have made an album. Instead, I made the pattern. And what is the pattern is you can basically go on and you enter your birth information and it tells you your pattern at the time of your birth, your psychological, emotional self. And it goes into great detail. That's sort of one of the things that set us apart. And again, it was because I was hungry for that kind of detail. So I wanted to put it into the app. And that's why the writing to me was so important. I really wanted it to go deeply. And I wanted the algorithms to be really robust so it could really feel like what it might be like if you got a real personal reading.
And to that point, I think it's important to note, like, while obviously it's astrology based, it's not presented as explicitly as most astrology is. The tagline is gain valuable insights about your most important relationships, and it's not focused on which planets are in which house, but the information is so thoughtful and presented on a number of different levels. I love it. Tell me about that decision, though, from a positioning perspective. It makes it feel very fresh and very thoughtful, but it's so different than what most people sort of traditionally do in this space.
Yeah, the reason for that was, again, just not wanting people to be turned off by it. You know, I might not have gone on to that app myself if I'd known it was astrology, right? It immediately shuts you down. I wanted no barrier to entry. I wanted people to just have this information available to them. I wanted to make it easy. So it was a very conscious decision from day one. And especially, this was 7 years ago. Now astrology is having this moment, you know, but certainly not back then. And even in my experience creating it, I would constantly be testing it, meaning I'd do everybody's reading it, all friends, Uber drivers, nurses. Everybody wants to feel seen and understood and can spend hours sort of diving into their life. The second you started bringing up the astrology, you could see they got a little confused. What does that mean? It's a whole nother language. It's complicated. So I wanted to really present something that anybody, any age, race, gender could benefit from and not have that thing of like, oh, it's an astrology app.
Right.
So much more than that. So that was, yeah, a very conscious choice. I didn't want any of that in the app. I just wanted it clean and simple and the information to be available.
So you launched in 2018 pretty quietly. Like, and by quietly, I mean there was no big press event. You didn't do a ton of PR and marketing, but there was like crazy word of mouth right off the jump. Did you have markers of success in your head about like, okay, I need this many people in beta before we launch, or I want it to grow by X percentage in the first year? Like, how were you thinking about success at that moment?
No, I mean, we didn't even launch. I wasn't even thinking of it that way. You know, this is, again, a self-funded thing because, you know, the company maker, I was able to self-fund, and I was so obsessively working on it. It was in a beta, but I'm talking like I sent it to 20 friends to test, right? There was no conscious launch at all. I basically woke up one day and there was 30,000 people on the server. To this day, I have no idea who these users were or how it happened or who shared that. It was just what? You know, all of a sudden it was launched. And it's good it did, because I think I would have kept tweaking and tweaking and tweaking forever. So it sort of happened. I say this a lot. It was like a field of dreams. If you build it, they will come. It was just like that. They just were there. And then it was word of mouth the entire time, which was such a gift, because it was just people from their heart saying to their friend, you got to get on it. And we just sort of had this consistent growth, these consistent signups every day. And we didn't have to do any marketing or any PR or explain what it was. It just spoke for itself, which was so beautiful to me. You know, I didn't want to launch it in some big thing. I wanted to let it grow like this. And this is the first time ever we're doing PR and marketing 3 years later. And I just love that. I love that it could be anybody's own experience. They didn't have to know who was attached to it or how it happened. It was a choice recently in terms of when you are growing a business and you are scaling it, at some point you have to sort of step forward and talk about it. But yep. If I had my sort of dream about it, it would have been great if I never had to do that.
But then we wouldn't be talking, Lisa.
I know. That's true.
But I get it. Also, like, you've been so in front of the camera and in front of things, like, it would make sense that you would want to create something that's not about you and that doesn't require you in front for a minute. But that day has arrived.
And that's how I feel. I think of it as like I'm sort of a mother of it. It has its own destiny. You know, you can't hold on too tight. It's not about me. You know, I'm here to create it and give birth to it kind of in a way and put it out there. But I love that it has its own destiny and it's everybody's. I want it to be their experience with it.
So if someone has not downloaded it, good things to know. For one, it's free. So it gives you access to your pattern, your timing, world timing, summaries about your friends' patterns. There's a load of stuff that's free. But then there's also a paid subscription option, which provides access to go deeper. And then this year, you also announced a dating product called Connect. So I'm curious if you can talk about that concept, how it will work, everything.
Yes. We only just started monetizing basically end of last year, because I always want to keep your pattern free and your timing free so you can always have access to that. And it's really going very deeper into friends and romantic, that there is the subscription and you can run bonds. But we always kind of had the thought we could go into dating. And it was something users were always asking for from the beginning. Mm-hmm. I would say the pandemic sort of pushed us to do it a little bit sooner, just seeing how much people want to connect and go deeper. And I think collectively we were going through something very intense together. And I think the app is trying to connect you in a more authentic way. And we wanted to do our dating version of that. So we're in beta now, and you can get on if you're in the US. Ideally this fall, we'll really sort of push it. But we've had a really wonderful beta and incredible feedback, and basically go on like you would any other dating app. But our differentiator is that you have to run the bond before you can like or chat or connect with somebody. And that's basically seeing your relationship compatibility, but not in a good or bad way. It's just sort of giving you the landscape of your relationship. Like, are you guys soulmates? Do you have an extraordinary relationship? Do you have a complex one? And then it gives you content around that. So right out of the gate, when you connect with somebody, you're kind of knowing, wow, this could be a pretty extraordinary thing. And you can talk about your past life karmic link, or, you know, talk about the dynamics of your relationship right away. So it's starting in a much deeper place.
So you have 7.5 million users, a incredibly organic and very loyal and dedicated following. Plus, there was so much conversation around the fact that you have a big fan in Channing Tatum, who, like, single-handedly, I feel like, boosted you guys in a really big way. I have to ask, what's next? I mean, obviously you have Connect, but where is this all going?
Yeah, I mean, again, this has all been just word of mouth. This is our first time actually trying to tell people about it. So I think we're always trying to improve the pattern. And I think a lot of that is about a certain scale and growing that core pattern audience, because the vision for this was really to better understand yourself, but also to connect with others in a deeper way. And I would love for people to better understand their friends, or if they're meeting somebody, sort of understand their pattern, not just the superficial things you might see about their resume on Google or their Instagram photos, but like check somebody's pattern, get a sense of what they're going through. They might be going through a really challenging time or have a very specific insecurity that you're taking personally. So I think there's always that piece of growing the pattern and wanting the world to know more about it and localizing, be in a lot of different countries and a lot of different languages. And then doing that with romantic dating, doing that with family dynamics, doing that with work relationships. So I see us growing in various verticals as well, but always with the idea of just as many people as possible to use it so that they can ideally have an experience that is helpful and supportive in their personal relationships.
So one of the things that we talk about on this podcast a lot is how our first lives and the skills that we learn there so often have this direct application to our second lives and the things that we evolve into. So I'm wondering if you can tell me about some of the things that you learned in your first life, how they are applicable to what you're doing now with the pattern.
So much. Oh my gosh. I think even just the experience of going through that kind of journey of creating your own business, you know, investing, the stakes, people, business, all that stuff informed the second experience, because, you know, you don't know anything. You make every mistake possible the first time. Not that I didn't make a bunch of mistakes the second time too, but, you know, it's as though you've maybe gone to school a little bit, right? So you're coming in with a little more understanding. I think being very flexible in my first, you know, maker, all that stuff, you had to learn how to be very adaptable, very flexible. Your ego has to get out of the way. It was just understanding how to have that sort of drive, but also patience with the process and let it take the time it needs to take. You know, it's been 7 years with this one.
Yeah. Also, I would imagine not having looming debt over your head probably.
Oh, gosh. I should have said that first. Yeah, it's a very different experience when you're not in tremendous debt and that kind of, those kinds of stakes aren't there. Of course they are. And, you know, I have a staff and I have wonderful people and you're self-funded, but it's a very different thing when you're going into it, being able to invest sort of in yourself without worrying that you'll spend the rest of your life digging yourself out of that hole.
But it is also kind of wild hearing you talk about the dedication of this singular focus that you had on creating, on writing, on learning 10 hours a day. You know, barely coming up for air. When you're really into something, you apparently don't have like a coast setting. Like, there's a level of work ethic and drive that I very much see in your first life that you're still clearly applying.
Yes.
Are you more balanced now?
Yes, that's what I would say. Actually, the pattern has been the most important relationship of my life. It's like I've been in a relationship with the pattern for 7 years because, especially when you're running it yourself this time, it's not as collaborative as the last time. You can't really blame anybody else, right? You can't be like, oh, it's the pattern's fault. It's such a wonderful mirror back to you about you and your own behavior. And through this process, I've just evolved a lot personally. And I mean, the way I'm completely different in that sense. And it's not really ambition driven. It's not so much trying to prove anything. You know, I think when you're younger and different insecurities, and maybe you're trying to prove things to certain people. And this was much more from the heart. And it was about me learning to find balance in my life and not make it all about that. There was something cathartic and I needed that experience, that creating part of it. Mm-hmm. But then it's been wonderful just to bring on a team and not have to run everything. I have the most incredible people that work for me. I just love them so much and, you know, empowering them to do the job so I can step back. I'm so supported and I don't feel overwhelmed anymore. Now it's sort of a joy, as opposed to maybe the first time where there was a lot of joy, but it was very intense and such a grind. Whereas this has been a very different kind of experience because my life is so much more balanced.
It just makes me think of something else, though. You really honed your ability to spot talent in your first life. And then hearing you talk about your team, it seems you've brought that along, albeit in a different way. What makes you certain that someone's the right hire? Because that, I think, is the hardest part of work, right?
It's everything. Yeah. And I'd say even in the beginning, I was so fresh off the maker experience too. That's what I mean by the pattern teaching me so much. I feel like I've evolved so much through it. Mm-hmm. I would say even in the beginning, maybe I didn't make all the right hire. I was still doing some old behaviors, and that's what's been so great. Now I feel much clearer about how I hire and the type of people I surround myself with. And how do you know? I think a lot of it is spotting what somebody is great at, you know, and not putting them in a position that they're not really suited for.
Right.
That was a mistake I used to make a lot. And, you know, you're trying to figure out what's going wrong. You're like, they're overwhelmed because this is not the best position for them. You know, this is not what they do. So I think I'm much clearer on that of, okay, this person is fantastic at this, but they also really want to do this. I'm always like, don't force anything. You know, do you want to do this? Because I want it to be a joy for people too. And because the pattern is mission driven and it's in service in some way, I think also it's brought in a certain kind of team of people right, that are very inspired by that. And they love it as much as I do, you know, and it was so wonderful getting the right people because then I could really rest for a minute. You really run out of energy, especially it was 3 years YouTube, 5 years maker, you know, and then 3 years almost on my own with the pattern. And I brought in one of my oldest, dearest friends of 20 years, mother of three. And I said, can you help me? And she was the first, you know, and then I started finding all the right people. And then you don't have to be the locomotive as much because their energy comes in and it re-inspires the whole thing. You're like, oh, okay. And then you chill for a bit, you know, and then you come back and you're refreshed and you're doing it together as a team. And I'm just really lucky.
So we also like to talk about mistakes on this podcast because everyone makes them in their career and we don't always talk about it. We often tend to focus on sort of the highlight reel. And while that is great and important, I think talking about the messier moments, the teachable moments is also very important. So can you tell me about a mistake that you've made in your career and something that you've learned from it?
Oh my gosh. So many. But I don't think of them as mistakes in that way. I think they're such great lessons and tools. Objectively, they're mistakes, right? But they wind up really showing you yourself. Everything becomes a mirror for you of like, okay, well, why did I do that? I would say most of my mistakes came from a place of knowing in my gut and my intuition what was right and the choice I wanted to make and ignoring it. I used to do that a lot more when I was younger, where you know, and I think it's really that process of going through building these businesses and doing this day in and day out is learning to trust yourself. And I think usually when life opens up and the business is working and things are thriving, you're sort of trusting what you know. And I think whenever you're sort of betraying yourself in a certain way and going against kind of what you know, you run into a lot of trouble. And then you get into people pleasing or making decisions that are not coming from, you know, an authentic, real place. That's usually it. And I think you go back and be like, okay, well, why did I do that? You know, and ultimately it's, you know, not trusting what you know. So I try and cultivate that. I try and, you know, listen more to that voice now and trust it.
Yeah. A lot of the folks who listen to this podcast are in their first life. They are interested in doing something else. They want to pivot in some way or another, but they're hesitant or just haven't figured out how to make that leap yet. As someone who's had a few pivots in her career, what advice would you give someone who wants to do that next thing, but just isn't quite there yet?
I think a lot of that hesitation too, you know, can be about fear of failure or fear of what people are going to think or say, or again, not trusting yourself. Mm-hmm. So I think the best advice I could give is really let that go. Because whatever that failure, that concern is, usually it's something that 10, 20 years from now, you're not going to care about. You know, you're going to fail in somebody's eyes, or, you know, you're going to lose a little bit of money. It doesn't matter. You know what I mean? Think of it as the journey. Think of it as the experience. And don't be so concerned, I'd say, about those kinds of what we'd say objective failures are. If you can look at it as a life experience, and if you can try and really trust yourself, because I think it goes back to that too, where can be afraid to trust ourselves. But if you really can and let go a little bit of that fear and sort of dive in, you will at the very least come out with probably an incredible experience, whether it works out objectively or not.
So my last question is also my favorite question, which is, if you could go back in time and speak with a younger Lisa at any point in her career and give yourself some advice, what would you say?
I think if I could go back and give myself some advice, I'd be less hard on myself. I think when I was younger, I was so hard on myself. And I'd just be like, just give yourself a break, you know, just give yourself a break. You're enough. Enjoy it. And yeah, don't be so tough on yourself.
We are so hard on ourselves.
Oh my God, it's ridiculous.
Lisa, this was so amazing. Thank you so much for your time. I cannot tell you how much I enjoyed this. I loved getting a chance to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Really grateful. Thank you.
That was the founder and CEO of The Pattern, Lisa Donovan. For more inspiring interviews with women like Lisa, head on over to secondlifepod.com, where we have so many more for you to peruse. If you like today's show, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to rate and review us. We love seeing you spread the word on social, and now you can tag us in your posts. We are at Second Life Pod on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. We always want to know who you'd like to hear from on the show, so send in your requests to hello@secondlifepod.com, or you can DM us on Instagram. I'm at Hillary Kerr. The show's at Second Life Pod. Our DMs are always open. I'm Hillary Kerr, and you've been listening to Second Life. Thank you to Saks OFF 5TH for sponsoring today's episode. Saks OFF 5TH brings you Saks style for less, up to 70% off full price. With amazing designer brands like Gani, Staud, and Stuart Weitzman, whether you're shopping for fresh, back-to-the-office looks, for that perfect piece for a special occasion, or to update your wardrobe for the new season with favorite staples, Saks OFF 5TH has you covered from head to toe. We're talking clothes, shoes, handbags, beauty, and more for both women and men, with new styles arriving daily. Experience the thrill of an amazing designer find at saksofffifth.com or at a store near you.